a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow out. It's Matt Bubala in for Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue. Joining us on the phone right now is award-winning space author and documentary filmmaker Rod Pyle, live from Shanghai. Hey, Rod, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you this evening?
I'm good. What's going on in Shanghai? What are you up to out there?
Well, it's kind of a foggy, smoggy day here, but it's a sensational city. I came out here for a couple of business things, but mainly because I wanted to see some of their space technology and talk to some of the people involved with it. And that's been a little bit of a challenge, but I think we're putting it together, so I'll be here for about a week. And as you probably know, their space program is going great guns and following a similar trajectory in a much compressed sense as ours did in the 60s and 70s, early 70s. So it's a fascinating time to be here, and they've got a lot of money to throw at it, and it's going to be quite something to see that. So I'm writing a book about this kind of new emerging space age over the next number of months, and I really wanted to get their story in there.
Yeah, interesting. You know, you mentioned the smog. I think I saw a headline that, like, air traffic was grounded in some parts of China because the smog is so bad right now. Is that going on there right now?
It might be. I grew up in Los Angeles, where you could see the air you were breathing.
Sure.
Almost see what you were exhaling, and it wasn't because it was cold. It's because it was so sooty. But I haven't seen air like this since probably the 70s, when it made your lungs sort of breathe. And it's not all the time. It's occasionally. They're having this kind of winter inversion situation that they get, so there's only so much they can do. But, it's certainly a problem that's going to have to be faced in the near future because it's such an incredible city. I mean, you've got 25 million people living in this big, contiguous metropolitan area with all this history, you know, going back well over 1,000 years, plus you know, the history of the international involvement in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the done by the Bund, where all the various trading concessions were done for Western powers, and that's since been kind of repurposed by the government here, but it's still a fascinating area to see.
You mentioned that you've had some hiccups along the way. Are they pretty secretive about their space program? Is there a little bit of leeriness about you being over there doing research for a book?
Not said directly, but I think so. You know, it's still very closely connected with the military, much in the way the Soviet Union's was back when the Soviet Union was still a power. That said, you know, some of it's just the way it's done in countries like this, but some of it's also a reaction, because in the U.S., although we have a completely civilian space program, you know, it's got some military components, but NASA is a civilian agency, and it's all very much on the up and up and in the open. We do have these regulations called ITAR, which is International Trade and Arms Registration. Anyway, it's limits on what you can ship overseas, what information you can share. So if NASA is working with international partners, even the Canadians, for Christ's sakes, you have to be very careful what you say, and a lot of stuff is limited. And so when you're dealing with China, there's a lot of limitations. So I think some of it may just be a direct response to that, a little bit of pushback.
Interesting. And you mentioned that they've got a lot of money. They're really pushing forward on space programs. Are they, you know, NASA has become such an international cooperative, right? I mean, we've worked so much with other countries, helps defray costs. If everybody's doing it, let's all just get together. China's still pretty much going it on their own right now. They want to establish their dominance in this area.
Well, it would appear that way, although not entirely by choice. You know, a big part of the space station being put up in the 90s was to engage Russia, now that it was post-Soviet Union, with our space program, because they had a very powerful and successful space program of their own. We managed to win the race to the moon, but they've done a lot of other incredible things. And where we would build a system and sort of throw it aside and then build something new, they've been working with basically the same space hardware since the early 1960s. So then there was talk of working with China, and China was certainly interested in working on the space station at various times, but for a lot of different reasons, mostly having to do with intellectual property and technological transfer and so forth. It was decided on the United States side that probably wasn't going to be something that we wanted to do. There's an awful lot of people within NASA and people that have been engaged with NASA or engaged with that area of endeavor, such as Buzz Aldrin, who have agitated and you know, made a lot of done a lot of writing about why it's important to work with a power like China and what the benefits can be. But there's still an awful lot of concerns about the politics of it and technology getting out of the bag and so forth. I don't think anybody's fooling themselves that everything's being kept a secret, but there are certain national security concerns that they want to keep highlighted. But, you know, China made their greatest strides by putting people in orbit in the last 10 years and by building a couple of small space stations, kind of hinging off of Russian hardware designs that they licensed and then improved. But you're right, they are kind of going their own way, and we may join up with them later in the game. But if not, they're trying to put astronauts on the moon by the 2020s.
By the 2020s. When are we hoping to get back to the moon? Because that's also something we're doing. Are they going to beat us back there? Is there going to be an actual race to the moon again?
Well, that's a really timely question you just asked. You've just stepped right out in the middle of the minefield and heard all the switches click at once around you and gone, oops. You know, we weren't really planning to go back to the moon. There was a plan to do that under second President Bush in the early 2000s. And then that was canceled when the Obama administration came in. That was called Constellation. So we spent a lot of money and built some hardware, and then it got canceled for some good reasons, but it still was a waste of time and funding. And then the decision was made, okay, we're going to have this general thing called the Flexible Path to Mars, which is we'll do these sequential step-by-step technologies. We'll rendezvous with an asteroid. We'll do some high Earth orbit work. We might do some work in orbit around the moon, but not land there again because we've already done that, and then eventually head out to Mars. But it's not been well defined, nor has it been particularly well funded, because we still got other expensive things to keep going, like the space station, which flies around every 90 minutes and absorbs billions of dollars of funding every year.
Yeah.
And it does some really good work. And you need a facility like that, whether it's that or something else, to investigate how you're going to make this 5 or 6 month journey out to Mars. But, you know, how you do that and how you spend that money impacts directly on how you're going to get to Mars. So how long that's going to take is anybody's guess. Now, with the Trump administration coming in, they're bringing some people onto their transition team, a number of them that seem to be much more focused, and I really accentuate much more focused on returning to the moon, dealing with more achievable goals. This is someplace that's a few days away by flight instead of months, and then making that next big step. And there are a lot of people who think that might be a really good thing.
What do you think about that? Would you rather we keep shooting for... I imagine that the frustration has got to be sometimes that when administrations change, you know, these space exploration programs need to be so long-term that it's very difficult when we change administrations and then change what we think the priorities should be. So then, you know, you only have so much funding and get so far, and then somebody changes the plan again, and now you're back to square one, and billions of dollars were wasted, not through NASA's fault, through administrative fault, right? And so then they look bad, though, because, well, we just spent $8 billion on that. We didn't get anything out of it. And they're like, well, that was the plan. You need, you know, 5 more years to get the payoff, but now you changed the game. Is that the most frustrating thing about this, or is it that we're not choosing things that you know, administration to administration, they're going to say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's keep that going.
Well, that's all correct. I mean, we have this problem right now. We're looking at the super booster that we've been building for a number of years called the Space Launch System, SLS, and the Orion capsule, which is a deep space exploration spacecraft that are way over budget and way over schedule, and we're not quite sure what we're going to do with them. So even if they are finished in the next few years, they're very expensive to fly, so looking at maybe flying once a year. Where do you go and what do you do? And that decision hasn't been made. When we were flying to the moon, and mind you, we had 10 times the budget in equivalent money terms that we do now, so
Wow.
We were spending a lot of money to go to the moon. But they were doing that when I was a kid, and those flights were leaving about every 2 months. We were going on these big 10-day missions to the moon and back to explore the valleys and the mountains and everything else, and now we're struggling to figure out what to do with the rocket we're building. So it's really hard to say. I mean, personally, I've always been kind of a return to the moon advocate. I try to temper that because there are people that get sort of mad at me when I say that sometimes. No, we ought to be putting everything in and going to Mars. And I do think that Mars is the ultimate objective. But the more that we find out, I say we, I mean, this is going to NASA conferences and so forth, the more they learn about traveling in space over extended periods of time, living in orbit and zero G over extended periods of time, the more we're finding out over long term, it's a place that really doesn't like people very much. You know, the bodies change, the fluids in your body get redistributed, your eyes change shape, sometimes permanently. There can be brain damage and neural issues, almost like dementia and forgetfulness, which is really bad when you're flying in space. There's huge radiation problems, and it's not just when you're in flight, whether you're on the surface of the moon or the surface of Mars or somewhere else. You've got radiation coming from the sun. You've got radiation of a different kind coming in from outside the solar system. And all these things just don't like bags of sentient meat and water, which is basically what people are.
Yeah.
And that's on top of the vacuum and the temperature and all that. So I think the moon is a really good step, and it's something that we know we can accomplish because we did. And it's something that we can probably do very well internationally because the Russians have a lot of experience in technologies that would be helpful there. The Europeans have indicated a strong interest in building a collaborative lunar village that would be a multinational base. How much money they would put to that is something that we'd have to discuss, but they've proven many times they've got the technology. And then we can continue doing the robotic thing at Mars until we're really ready to make that step. And that involves a lot of things like learning how to process the atmosphere into things that we can use, like water and rocket fuel and so forth. And these are all ideas that have been fairly well explored on Earth, but you need to take them up there and make sure they work.
Yeah.
So maybe we can surprise when you land and go, hey, it didn't work when I hit the go button.
Yeah. So maybe a better idea to learn how to live in space on the moon, which is a lot closer and a lot easier to get to, a lot less expensive, instead of spending so much money on the just getting there part, which we would have to do with the Mars mission. We could probably more economically put more people on the moon for longer periods of time, really get a better idea of what's going to happen long term or how that's going to work. And like you said, we've got robots on Mars. We're getting a lot of data, a lot of information. Getting to Mars, I guess getting a human to Mars is more just a feat that we can say we did versus maybe, would you say that the payoff of actually having somebody there is more psychological than scientific? You know, we can find all of these things, or we're finding so much information by having the robots there versus, you know, having 10 people living on the moon for a year. That would really give us much more scientific information on how this would work when we eventually do make it to somewhere that we have to travel further out, where you can't get back more quickly, where we can't get stuff to them as quickly in emergency, things like that.
There's a lot of people that would agree with that, and there's a lot of people that would say, well, you really get more out of Mars because it's a better place to go. It is a bigger mountain to climb. It is a bigger project to undertake. There would be more of a big tech push, which is what made the Apollo program so successful and so beneficial for society, because so many things were invented and explored and investigated and undertaken to make that work. You know, one thing about Mars is it does have an atmosphere. It's thin, but it's there. It does have huge reserves of water. I mean, they're finding enough water to make an ocean probably at this point, I would guess, if you melt it at all 80, 90 feet deep across the whole planet. I mean, there's huge reserves of liquid water, some salty, some fresh, we think, but enough that you've got an awful lot of stuff there for breathing and fuel and so forth. So that's fantastic. I mean, you've got resources there that can keep you going for a long time. The moon has some of the same stuff, but it may be harder to get at. We're not really sure yet. So, you know, there's benefits to both, but I think in general terms, you're right. I mean, let's do the moon first, really develop that technology, and in parallel, do the step to Mars. The one downside of the whole robotic program is they have to be made smarter to be able to do more in a short period of time. You talk to anybody who's worked on this program as much, either on the engineering or the scientific side, and they'll very freely admit, you know, I could do, if I had a field geologist up there, a human being in a pressure suit, I could do, you know, 5 years worth of work in a couple of days, because rovers are just very slow and they don't have intuition and they're not terribly autonomous. They're becoming more autonomous. And by the time, you know, we start sending them, hopefully every few years, once Elon Musk gets his Mars circuit up and flying, fingers crossed, I think that may advance much more quickly. But, you know, there are benefits to having people there. By the way, it should be noted, you know, we've completely ignored the Elon Musk conversation.
Well, I mean, here's a guy we're going to get to that. Yeah, definitely. Because there is a whole question about private, private work in the space industry versus NASA and completely government funded work. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break. We'll get into that next. We're speaking with Rod Pyle. He's an award winning space author and documentary maker. PyleBooks.com for information on everything he's got out there. PyleBooks.com. We'll talk more next. 720 WGN. If you Matt Bubala in for Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio speaking with Rod Pyle. He is overseas. He's in China at the visiting the Shanghai Science and Technology Museum and other things as he writes his latest book about space exploration. Rod, tell me a little bit more about the book. What so your China's an aspect of it. Is it just all about the current current ventures that we're having, all the different, not just NASA and international community, but you've mentioned Elon Musk, the SpaceX program, everything else going on?
Yeah, it's all that and more. I mean, it's really intended for the motivated layman, if you will, you know, general public, the people who are interested in this kind of stuff, looking briefly at kind of how we got to where we are with the whole new space area, which is the private companies and the private government collaborations we're seeing in the U.S. and things like the Google Lunar X Prize to land a robot on the moon with a private concern and so forth, but also looking ahead at the next 20 years of how this is likely to evolve. And we've seen a lot already with SpaceX coming out of virtually nowhere 12 years ago with a young guy who had sold his chunk of fortune out of PayPal and said, hey, I want to build rockets for you guys at NASA, and I'm going to fly your satellites. And they said, yeah, that's nice. Check back with us. You've got something. And he did. And he went and built rockets, and it was tough, and it was a big challenge, but he succeeded in doing that. So his story, Jeff Bezos of Amazon is doing something similar. There's a lot of other private concerns. And then there's the international area, and it's been much slower there for various reasons, largely just the way that the economies and the government control the economies is structured. It's been much more difficult for private individuals to accomplish what they're accomplishing in the U.S. We also have a lot of billionaires here, which doesn't hurt. But they are coming along and starting smaller ventures, and eventually will probably do something similar. So it's a really exciting area, and so I'm trying to canvas. I think I've talked to, I probably interviewed 35 people at this point in various, within NASA, within SpaceX and the other private concerns and international consortiums, including China, hopefully, and just trying to find out what people's plans are, realistically, what they think will happen, what some of the critics are saying, and just get a picture of what this is all going to look like in the next 10 to 20 years and how it can benefit us, because that's really the important thing. You know, the average person needs to know there's something in this for them besides the idea that it's wonderful to explore and it's a great philosophical venture. That works up to a point, but then people say, that's great, but, you know, I like having iPods and my Cadillac and things like that. What's in this for me? And you kind of have to begin to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The international community, I imagine that's an issue just like we talked about here in the U.S. as we change leadership in the White House. And so priorities change and ideas on what we should be doing with NASA changes. And that's a stumbling block for us here. But I imagine with the international community as well, not only do you have leadership changes from the various countries that get involved, but also economic changes. And I imagine that when we're making long-term plans like this, that's got to be really tough because you get a commitment from a country that, okay, we're all in for this, but then suddenly, you know, the EU has its issues, or there's Brexit, or there's a world economic recession. And so it gets tougher for people to stay with those commitments. But then, you know, somebody like China, say, or some other country becomes more flush with cash and they want to increase their stature maybe in the world. And space is kind of a sexy thing to plant your flag on, right? To say, hey, look at how big and powerful we are. We're strong and we're proud of it. It's sort of like, you know, hosting an Olympics, but it's a way to flex your muscle and your brain power and your cash to jump in. So it's got to be a kind of weird thing as the years go by, and who jumps in, who falls out, who comes back. And when you have these international consortiums, is it tough for everybody to stay on track and keep putting in the money that they commit to?
Yes, it is. That's all true. And it's also true in the other direction. NASA made some significant commitments to the Europeans for their ExoMars project, which is a orbiter rover combination that they're flying in two different sets. One went up this year and the other one will go up in, I think, now 2020. And then NASA backed out of that for various reasons. And primarily the Russian Space Agency took up that part of it and said, okay, we'll do that. So I think NASA's still got some connective tissue. You know, they tend to help in command and control and navigation because we've gotten very good at that over the decades. But we actually pulled out a significant amount of money and technical support, and the Europeans weren't real happy about that. So they just, you may have seen, they just had a spacecraft that went up. It was the first ExoMars. It was an orbiter that worked, and then a lander that was a a design combined between the Russians and the Europeans. And the poor, you know, the Russians have been aiming at Mars for as long as we have, back since the early 60s, and have yet to have a fully successful mission. They had a few firsts. They had the first lander, but it didn't last long. And they had early orbiters that were successful, but really, that were partially successful in reaching the planet, but they've never had a fully successful Mars probe, so that's been very frustrating for them. And then just a few weeks ago here, the Schiaparelli lander, which they were doing at the Europeans, also crashed and didn't succeed. So we got our fingers crossed for them for 2020. But yeah, it is very frustrating because these are ever-shifting sands. Like you said, there can be small changes in the situation in Europe, or Europe versus Russia, or, you know, the West versus the East, or wherever, whatever set of powers you're talking about, which changes people's priorities, so money gets pulled out, or, as is the case with us and China, for instance, these political considerations really get in the way, or even us with Russia.
Yeah,
they were supplying rocket engines for our national security launches, and then the Ukraine situation comes along, and guys like John McCain say, you know, I'm not really sure we should be buying rocket engines for our military satellites from Russia. They're not our friends on this. So, but that's, you know, every problem causes an opportunity somewhere else. So that's been actually a good thing for guys like Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Blue Origin Rockets and SpaceX with Elon Musk, because they're going to pick up a lot of that slack.
Let's get into that after the break. We're going to take a quick break for the news, but I want to talk a little bit more about private funding versus public funding. And I want to ask Rod about this. You know, he mentions that Russia's had this trouble getting the success with Mars. I wonder, are we all really in this together now, or do we still have a bit of a Cold War mentality over we want to be the best and we don't want people to surpass us, whether we have the funding or not? Is there still a bit of gamesmanship on who succeeds and who's the superpower still when it comes to space and technology, with China breathing down everybody's neck and everything else going on? Are they really all working together as well as we need to be, maybe, to get some of these things done? Rod Pyle, pylebooks.com. We'll have more after the news. Thank you, Vic Vaughn. Matt Bubala in for Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Rod Pyle, space author, award-winning space author. He's a documentary maker, and he's in Shanghai researching his latest book. And Rod, before the break, we were starting to talk a little bit about, I do want to ask you, because you mentioned, you know, that Russia hasn't had the best record of success when it comes to their Mars missions. Do we still, at least privately, maybe, not root against them, but you know, there is a bit of a rivalry there, and Russia and the U.S. have had a very interesting relationship, certainly in the last 6 months, with our election and with Crimea and everything over the last year or so. So where are we at as the space community? Is there still a bit of a Cold War mentality, or are we all for one for all?
Let me give you the official answer. No, we wish our allies and partners in space all the best success. So then you talk to everybody else, and it's kind of all over the map. I think the interesting, you know, there are people with very good reasons who study economics, who study space policy, who work in these areas. I was talking to a gentleman the other day about the Chinese space effort, and he said, you know, I wish them all the best luck in the world. They've got money, they've got technological prowess, they're brilliant engineers and scientists, and they're going to do really great things, but, and he's an American citizen, but he said, but I want to see us do that. You know, we started this a long time ago. We developed and abandoned a number of major systems, whether it be the shuttle, and there were reasons for shutting that down, or the Apollo hardware, which didn't have such good reasons for shutting it down. We could still be using it. And other hardware systems that we developed that we could still be using to do really incredible things at the moon and possibly beyond. But we just have this pattern of developed shutdown, develop, shutdown, develop, shutdown. Public interest wanders. With public interest goes Congress, and because their constituents are less concerned about it, unless they're building a chunk of some new project. And so that goes away. But then you talk to individual congressmen whose level of awareness and understanding of what's going on in space with technology and policy and everything else is all over the map from 1 to 10, as you might imagine. And in some cases, they parrot the line about, yes, you know, we want to work with the international community. And in other cases, there are people that come up very strongly and say, I want this to be an area where America shines, because we don't have as many of those as we did after World War II in the 50s and 60s. And the thing about space exploration and space development is it's one of the few things we still do better than anybody in the world besides, you know, software and certain other elements of technology and, you know, weapons development. We do space very well, and just about every dime that's spent on it is done here. I can't think of any place else where that happens. I mean, my Chevy is something like 60% made overseas, at least in terms of the parts and components. Space programs are done here by Americans in American factories. They're fed by American restaurant workers. They're educated for the most part in American schools. There are people all over the world who want to come to American schools and work with NASA and other space initiatives. So it really, in so many immediate ways, is good for the country, and in a lot of long-term ways, in terms of both investment and spin-offs, is good for the country. So I think there is still an appreciable percentage of the electorate and people in politics and in government who really feel, yeah, we do want to be the best at this. Should we be in international partnerships? Probably, if they work well. But as we found out with the space station, they can be pretty expensive, and you don't always save a whole lot because, as you pointed out earlier, things get complex. They slow down, they speed up. Somebody's late on developing components, so then we have to go ahead and do it, or vice versa. So there's good arguments for both, and I hate to sound so wishy-washy. If you're asking me personally, yeah, I want to see us do it.
Yeah. I think any American would love to see us do it, but then when you come to them and say, okay, but that's going to cost us X billions of dollars, and that's going to affect everything else, then it gets a little tougher. And I imagine that the international partnerships, does that help when we transition administration to administration? Because, you know, you go to the whoever the new president is and say, listen, you know, maybe this isn't your favorite idea, but we've committed this to it. And because we have this international partnership, it's only costing us X versus X, 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 X. We should really stick it out. Does it make it more likely, at least, that we'll keep something going versus if we were running it all on our own?
It can, you know, and those numbers are a little gooey anyway. I mean, things are constantly underbid or underrepresented in terms of dollars when they're being taken forward to the people that have to make the decisions, because if you told them the real cost, they'd say, are you crazy? So you give them the best shot you can, round it down a bit, and hope that it'll stay somewhere within that range. But it's interesting. I remember, I think I might have been on WGN years ago, about 2012, when Curiosity landed, and somebody called in and said, you know, this was expensive. This is $2.5 billion. That's a lot of money. What are we going to get out of it?
Yeah.
There's the usual answer of, you know, exploration, science, understanding the solar system, and possibly the origin of life and all that. But let's put it in context for a second. That was, I believe, at the height of our Middle East involvement, 7 years ago, whatever it was. We were spending that much money about every 5 days. So would you rather have 5 days of war in the Middle East or this incredible Mars exploration program that's probably going to go on for a decade and may answer the, or come very close to answering, big questions about the origin of life as we know it in the solar system, or well beyond that? Now, I realize that I'm comparing very different political agendas and objectives here, but when you put it in that perspective, space doesn't seem so expensive, and we're spending a half of 1% of our national budget on space right now. At the peak of the Apollo program spending is 66. We were spending a little under 5%. I think it was 4.6, 4.7. So we're not spending very much. And with that money, we're not just building a moon rocket and sending one or two robots to Mars like we were in the 60s. We've got a space station. We've got all this Earth observation infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure. We've got a probe out by Jupiter. We've got a number of orbiters and rovers on Mars. So we've got this huge investment in space infrastructures going on, employing people, buying products, keeping a big chunk of the economy going. And that money is essentially a great big pass-through in a lot of ways. So there's a good argument for supporting it in that light.
Yeah, absolutely. And beyond that, you know, there is also something to be said about keeping kids interested in science and trying to get the future generations excited about, you know, the complexity of these missions means we need kids learning math and science in schools and becoming the brilliant engineers of tomorrow. And I would imagine that's always a concern.
It's a huge concern. You spend time at places like, I spend a lot of time at JPL and Caltech and some at Kennedy in Florida and in Houston and so forth. And you talk to people working on these programs. And I walk into these rooms, you know, I'm a journalist, right? So I'm just this klutz there to cover the thing and listen to what they're talking about. But I'm in this room where I'm, you know, I'm bringing the age average up by about 20 years because I'm in a room with 20 and 30-year-old PhDs and master's graduates who are brilliant, who are motivated, who are so smart they have heat radiating off their heads practically. And, you know, a lot of them got engaged by hearing about the Apollo program or seeing the shuttle program or watching Star Trek or God knows Star Wars. I can't tell you how many people were motivated by that. And they are driven by this deep-rooted burning passion to do this. And it's incredibly inspiring to see. But as you know, the numbers of people going into those fields, at least American nationals, is falling. And an awful lot of people coming in from other countries who are very driven and learning the stuff. Some of them stay and work for the United States. A lot of them go home, and you have this kind of de facto technology transfer going on in their heads. So, yeah, it's really important to keep people motivated. NASA has a small budget for that, but that's why there's an awful lot of people like me that keep trying to write these books and write articles and make films and so forth, because you really want to say, this is important, this is good. NASA is one of the most recognized and beloved brands in the world, way ahead of Coca-Cola and Forever 21, and it's a good thing. So, you know, come join the party.
Forever 21's getting thrown in there with Coca-Cola, huh? They've really come a long way.
That was a bit of a stretch, wasn't it?
Maybe a little bit.
I should have said Hilton. Maybe Hilton.
All right, so let's talk about private versus public, because NASA has the budget issues, governments have budget issues, but we have a lot of new money in the world, I think, is part of what's driving the space exploration, when it's Tesla and Amazon and Google and these companies that 20 years ago didn't exist that now have billionaires heading them who have a lot of money to play with. And I think they're, kind of all because I think by nature and the businesses they run, they're kind of geeky guys who are probably just in love with the idea of space exploration. And suddenly they find themselves with the money to actually do something about it. So we have all these different consortiums working on privately sending people to Mars or into space or launching satellites. And how good or detrimental can that be? And I know on the surface, it's like, well, hey, more money coming into it is great. But that could also mean that governments say private business can do this, so we don't need to put the government money into NASA. And I would imagine that could really hurt things in the long term as well.
It could. It's important to note that when you've got a situation like SpaceX, which is competing with the only other major launch provider at this point, which is United Launch Alliance, which is a Lockheed Boeing partnering, ULA gets paid before the launch. You know, they get their money to go launch the rocket, and they cost a lot. It's about 2.5 times or triple what SpaceX charges. But they've been doing it since the 50s or 60s, and as one entity or another, and doing it a long time, and they're good at it. So the government pays for that, and it's the traditional aerospace cabal. When you get over to something like SpaceX, Elon Musk has put a lot of money into it. He started the company. He designed the rockets. He tested and got them flyable on his own money and the money of private investors. But the government has also put a lot of money into it by agreeing to buy a certain number of launches at a certain price. Now, to switch over to the other side again for a second, Musk is charging them, I think, at this point, between 50 and 60 million a launch, whereas United Launch Alliance is charging well into the hundreds. They're never really clear on exactly what the number is. So, you know, it's a tremendous deal for the taxpayer, and a lot of the R&D and testing and so forth was done on Elon Musk's dime. But it is still, in many ways, a NASA-driven program in terms of cash. But then you go to something like the Mars program he talked about a couple months ago in Guadalajara, which is, that's him. That's his money. That's his idea. I'm going to build this mega rocket that looks like something out of a 1950s cartoon, and it's going to launch and refuel in orbit and take 70 people to Mars in somewhere between 3 and 4 months, depending on which version you're looking at. And when you stop and say, that's really great, what's the business case for that? Because I understand how you and Jeff Bezos and other people are going to make money launching people to the space station, launching satellites into orbit, launching things potentially further out towards the moon, and doing tourist flights. But what's with the Mars deal? And there really isn't a business case there. You know, it's just a place that we think we ought to go. And these are guys that, as you said, feel like they really want to do this. You can call them geeks if you want. I think they're prophets, but one way or the other, this is something that they really decide they want to put their money where their mouth is and do it and see it happen. And if that's on their own dime, that's how it works. So it's fantastic. I don't think it jeopardizes NASA except in certain ways. When you've got SpaceX has a rocket coming along called the Falcon Heavy, which is three of their normal Falcon 9s basically strapped together to make a big, heavy lift rocket that significantly threatens what NASA's been doing, puttering along with the Space Launch System. So at a certain point, do you need that big NASA rocket, or can you just use a number of the larger SpaceX rockets and just, you know, pay a lot less for them than it's costing you to develop the rocket nozzle for the SLS? And that's a really good question. And this administration coming up will probably be the one that either guarantees the SLS's continuation of success or puts a bullet in it and says we're going to private industry.
And what do you think we should do? I mean, based on, you know, you follow this like crazy. I know that's a loaded question, but is it dangerous for us to maybe in its infancy say, yeah, private industry can handle this when it comes to space?
Man, you're smart. Yes. Because even though we've been doing this for 50, 60 years, we've been doing it, at least in this country, the way NASA did, which is largely born of the technological orientation of the German engineers that came over after World War II, which is we control every step of the process. With the Saturn V rocket in the 60s, they knew where the ore was mined, who took it out of the ground, who smelted it, which plant it went to, who machined the component, and so on and so forth until it was screwed into the rocket, and how many foot-pounds of torque were applied and screwing it on the rocket. And if it went a quarter turn too far, you had to put a memo on it, and it went up the tree to management. The new companies obviously aren't doing it to that extent of you know, micromanagement, because they feel like they've got it figured out. They've got all this technological data from 50 years of NASA. So they're taking a much faster path to flight, and we've seen that bite SpaceX a couple of times, possibly, with these rocket explosions. That's all well and good if you're blowing up a robotic satellite.
Yeah. But
in about a year and a half, they're going to have people on top of that rocket. So now is a moment to slow down for a second and say, okay, are we sure we got it right? Do we have to take these extra steps? So, yeah, if we had a calamity where we lost three or five astronauts going up on one of the private rockets, privately developed rockets, because there was a shortcut taken somewhere, which was what happened with not the last SpaceX explosion, but the one before it. It wasn't SpaceX's fault. It was a supplier who took a shortcut on a component and didn't report it, but it ended up destroying the rocket. If you start killing astronauts that way, you've got a real problem. So I think what you're saying is very wise. You know, there is really grounds for having both.
And that incident you're talking about where it wasn't SpaceX's fault, it was a supplier, but it was their supplier, right? I mean, they choose the supplier. They're working with these companies,
right.
And that's the danger, is that as expensive as our space program has been, and even though we have lost life over the years, I would imagine that they would say it's been incredibly safe overall when you look at the complexity of what we pulled off in the 50s and 60s and 80s. We have had accidents, and that has happened. But overall, they would argue, because of the time we've taken, because of the extra steps, and because of the extra money we've spent, we've gotten as far as we had. And while it's great to have all the information to go on now, and people want to break business models, and we can do it faster, cheaper, and better, but until it's not better, you know, because once SpaceX does lose, has a large loss of life. I mean, look at how long it took NASA to recover from the tragedies that we had with the Challenger mission and the other one. I mean, those were huge stopping everything events that set the agency back, I imagine, many years each time, right?
It did, 18 months at least. And that's a NASA thing. You know, if that happens in the private sector, if it's not a NASA underwritten mission and you're just dealing with the FAA and a couple of other government agencies, you know, at what point do they say, okay, you figured it out, move ahead? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. And that's one of the big kind of dark clouds looming ahead, is how do you rewrite all this government regulation for these private space concerns? And they're starting to work on it, but it takes a long time, as you know. And then there's also, you know, there's another model besides NASA. There's what the Russians have been doing since 1961, when they orbited their first cosmonaut. You know, they worked very quickly through a succession of spacecraft and came up to Soyuz, which was the one that they decided they were going to use to try and beat us to the moon. Didn't work for that, but it's been working really well ever since, and it's flown well over 1,000 times, and the loss rate has been incredibly low. Well, how do you achieve that? I mean, if you look at some of the hardware, not so much in the last 20 years, but earlier Soviet hardware, you kind of begin to suck air because you're looking at this thing that looks like it was, well, it looks like what you'd expect, right? If you look at an East German car from 1974 and are astonished that there's one part that isn't rusted or falling off, there was some components of the space program that struck you that way, but they were so robust and so over-engineered and have been built for so long that they just work and they don't kill people.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very reliable. So there's something to be said for a little less high tech, a little more let's keep building it the same until we get it as perfect as we can. It's still not cheap. We're paying, I think, at this point, $83 million for one seat in a Russian rocket to take our astronauts up to the space station. But I, from the math I've seen, that's probably well in excess of what it costs to launch that rocket and everything, you know, fuel, command and control, the hardware, everything else. I think we're paying for everybody to go up, but they know we don't have any options. So until we've got SpaceX or Boeing or one of the other companies taking people up there, we're paying the Russians. It's a really good deal for them.
Yeah, no kidding. And it seems like there's going to be some there's going to be some good cooperation in the next 4 years, so that's probably going to continue to work out. Real quick, Mars, there's all these competing missions, and I've spoken a bunch of times on the air with one of the finalists for the Mars One mission. She's selected to be one of these first astronauts that they're hoping to train and privately send to Mars on a one-way ticket to live out their lives on Mars. And there's other different private Mars plans, and there's our public Mars plans. What do you think is going to happen if you had your crystal ball out? Are we going to get to Mars in the next 10 years? Is it going to be a private company that does it? Is anybody really going to have the money to do it outside of a government agency?
I think for Mars One, I'm going to get out my old trusty eight ball, if you remember that one.
The
glass ball with the ink in it that you turned over, and the thing would come floating up the top and say, the spirits are misty, check back later.
Yeah.
You know? Mars One, I was at the conference where they rolled out the initiative. The guy who runs the thing, Baz Landorf, gave a talk. And, you know, there was a moment there of this emperor has no clothes. And I don't think anybody in the press at this point really knows how serious this is. They don't have any hardware. They don't really have a mission plan. They don't have any real hardware designs except something that they contracted out for a chunk of life support and a possible lander rover system. But in terms of this manned initiative, which is, you know, the schedule keeps getting pushed back 2 or 3 years at a time, but at this point I think it's the early to mid-2020s, you know, there's some telephones and desks in Holland, and as far as I know, that's it. Now, they did just sell a big chunk of their company to a telecom conglomerate out of Finland of kind of questionable background. So there is some investment funding there, but how much of that's going toward, you know, we're talking, I think, $6 million, so it's not a lot. They need billions to pull it off. So it's nice that people have a dream. It's nice that you know, citizens have gotten engaged in this. What concerns me about it is when that thing packs up and folds up and goes away, how does that impact other private endeavors? And people say, hey, wait, we really are serious about this, and we really do have some serious financial backing. Maybe it comes out of the guy who owns Alibaba in China, Jack Ma. Well, how many people are going to, the media is going to point back to Mars One and say, well, you're just like them, right?
Yeah.
So anytime you have something that's a little less than completely committed, it worries me a bit. But in terms of the broader picture, you know, I don't think we have any idea. I mean, there are people that look at Elon Musk's Mars plans and says, this is crazy. No technological showstoppers. It's just a question of scale and investment. But he's been such a remarkable human being in terms of this fanatic drive he has to pull off what he tries to pull off. Tesla could collapse tomorrow. SpaceX could collapse in 6 months. But they don't. They just keep on going. And I think you can't count him out. And Jeff Bezos has been much quieter about it. You know, that's a hard company to get news out of. We get bits and pieces, but this is Blue Origin. He's building his own rockets. He's tested them very successfully. He's starting to build much larger ones. He's supplying engines now for the next generation rocket that United Launch Alliance is putting together. So he's coming in to replace the one that we were buying from the Russians. So he's having incredible success and taking this very slow, careful, incremental, kind of off the public record approach. Hasn't been as specific about his plans for Mars, but I think any one of these guys are a potential contender for that mission, or a consortium of them. I wouldn't mind seeing three or four of them get together and say,
yeah,
let's blend incredible financial and technological power we have go to NASA, put it together in a way that keeps it from getting too hung up in bureaucracy and doesn't burn money, and make this happen. And after all, if you ever saw the old movie Destination Moon, that was a private-public partnership, and it worked out just fine.
I imagine, though, that there's competing egos there, too. I mean, with all this money comes my idea, and this is the way we should do it, and getting all of those heads in one room, to fit in one room maybe, would be tough, but also just to get everybody to agree this is the idea we should go with and pull the money together. That would be great, but I wonder if that's going to be a little too tough to make happen. Rod Pyle, it's been wonderful chatting with you. I really appreciate you excuse me, being out with us as long as you did. I hope we can talk again. He's writing his latest book on space. He's in Shanghai researching the China space program. You can find more at pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E books.com. Rod, thank you so much for jumping on with us.
Thank you. Have a great evening.